Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And among the things that are going to come up when you, in any instance of sharing the faith or living the faith, eventually the talks about gender and identity will happen. So we want to talk this time about how to talk to kids about gender and identity. Maybe it's the kids in your family, the kids, the grandkids, the great-grandkids, or maybe it's you'd like to talk with other adults about how to do that. And here to help us do that, we have a wonderful, very, very helpful voice in this field. Dr. Anna Samuel is our guest. She served as the first executive director of the Witherspoon Institute, which offers a whole bunch of different summer seminars for high schoolers, undergraduates, graduates, law students, and professionals. And the whole point of the Witherspoon Institute is to engage in intellectual debate and learning together to renew the culture by fostering that life. In 2013, she helped to launch Canavox, and I hope you will check out the work that Canavox does, where she works on overseeing the academic content and the ongoing education of state leaders. Dr. Anna Samuel, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is a tough one, in part because I'm thinking about the work that you do at the Witherspoon Institute, trying to renew the culture. The culture in its raw state doesn't, the way it exists now, the way most people encounter it day to day, it doesn't have the language really to challenge the kind of current gender ideology. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. You know, the retreat from Christianity has left a kind of vacuum and a philosophical vacuum, really. I think for so many hundreds of years, men and women all over the world received a basic philosophical education about what the human person was just by virtue of going to church on Sundays. And I don't think we realized how much of a philosophical education we got through the church.
Yeah.
And now that church attendance has dropped so much, it's left this vacuum in an understanding of what the human person is, what's our identity. And so now we have all these really, you could say heretical ideas about the human person, critical race theory, gender ideology, just coming in to fill in the gaps. And so ordinary men and women just don't know how to fight this because they've lost their footing. So yes, it's unfortunately, we really have to engage in a kind of renaissance of understanding what the human person is so that we can fight this and reframe the debate and understand what identity is the right way. Not these incorrect ways,
but and the as you say the flight from, I think you used the term, the flight from Christianity, or the letting go of Christianity, in any case, whatever it is, it's not a matter of Christianity. An intellectual replacement was found for Christianity. It's more the case that it seems that there are certain things that challenged people's faith in the modern era. You know, the discovery of the evolutionary theory and many other things, Freud's work, all these things. Okay, so these are real challenges. But also, we're somewhat wealthy and well-to-do and consumerist. And so there is a kind of giving up on Christianity more than there was of a new vision of the world was conceived and it surpassed it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I would say not so much, I would say giving up in some ways and distracted in others.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? We've been distracted by materialism and the kind of Marxist. I mean, I think the mention of Freud is very important. And I think I would add Marx to that list.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Fundamental conception of man as an economic being, and that our relationships are fundamentally economic ones, has also, these have been like tectonic, subtle shifts in our worldviews, and we haven't realized how groundbreaking they have been.
Right.
But these have been enormous shifts in the culture, and so, you know, men and women today are just busy going about their day, making money, going through the weeks, prioritizing other things, but they have fundamentally ordered their lives in these Freudian Marxist kinds of ways without even realizing it or consciously consenting to it. But it's definitely happening.
And I say that, and I wanted to kind of establish that groundwork with you because that has a huge effect on the conversations we're able to have. It's not like, well, you know, there was this Christian understanding of the world that brought with it the ancient philosophy and married these things in a way that each could enlighten the other, the reason and revelation. There's not like somebody came along and said, "Oh yeah, well we've come up with a new philosophical language to replace all that." More or less, it was lost without a replacement. Therefore, there's not a common language, and the key I'm trying to get to is what you're confronted with is a lot of emotion.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, there's been the loss of faith in human reason has been part of this retreat from Christianity. The loss of understanding that the human person is a body and soul unity. That's been another big one, right? So, the loss of respect for the human body as a fundamental part of who we are. That was all very, very intertwined with Christianity. And the more we stray from that, the more people are gained to think that really we're just ghosts and machines, and whatever we feel like being can be what we are. And this sort of divorce from the body has been very subtle as well, but that's part of what's been going on as well.
So then because we want to talk about how to talk to kids about gender and identity. So then now you have the child who's been educated, I don't know if educated is the word, but formed by the internet, by television, by very a sound bite and a strong emotion view. How do I talk to this kid about gender and identity?
Right. So really parents, or I'm assuming this, we're talking to parents, okay?
Okay, fair
enough.
Teachers,
of course, do have a role to play, but I'm taking as an assumption that parents are the primary educators of their children, and that other adults should respect that. So I'm going to really capitalize on the privilege that parents have in terms of love and time, and that they're with the children throughout their lives. So from a very young age, it's important. I would call it barnyard biology. It's really important to get over our own discomfort talking about other animals and their sexuality, and immerse our kids in as much of the natural sexual world as possible, because a lot of kids are on screens. And as you mentioned, you know, this kind of like digital age can slowly bring children out, sort of alienate them from nature and reality and biological reality, to the point where they're not very well anchored in how things are really. So the simple things like going from, I'm talking about really young children, right? Taking them to the farm and showing them the cows, the difference between the cows and the bulls, and just making sure that when they're very little, they understand the differences, right? And maybe they're a little older and they get to 10 and 11 and you start to explain how baby cows are made. And you start to explain sexual reproduction among mammals, right? Well, do you see that bull over there? He has a penis. And go ahead and say it. You know, we have to, as adults, get over our discomfort talking about these things with our children, and then explain. And he has to put his seed inside of the cow. And then she's going to grow the baby calves inside of her womb. And then those udders, those big pink balloon things that she has under her belly, that's where she's going to give perfect milk to her baby calves. This way, a young child grasps the idea of sexual reproduction without having to visualize mature human genitalia, right? So already from a very young age, you can start to introduce biological sexual reproduction to a young child so that it's always been part of their vocabulary. And then as they grow, you can now transfer it to human relationships and say, yeah, it's not very different from the cows and the bulls. And in other words, I wouldn't use birds and bees. I would use mammals. All right. And so cows, bulls, and then explain the differences between man and beast, that we are free beings, et cetera. We can get into that some more. But I do think that parents, we need to start getting over our own discomfort, addressing these things with our children so that it's comfortable for us. We model it for the kids so that they can then be comfortable asking us sort of awkward questions as they grow. It really has to become part of the language of family and parent and child communication. You're basically setting good precedents so that you are establishing yourself as the expert in your child's life. And as they grow, you also will grow in the ability to speak about these things.
What an extraordinary idea too, because the child gets to experience nature, which is one of the things that children are cut off from. I can imagine many people saying, they don't even know where a farm is. many people, they don't even know related to where I live right now. I don't know where a farm is. So maybe a zoo? I don't know.
I mean, the dog park can probably serve your purposes too, right?
Yeah. But you call it barnyard biology so that the child sees the normalness of and the reality of the kind of sexed existence of creatures.
Yes, exactly. And we can talk about it some more in the context of what identity is, you know, because our sexual identity is just one part of our human identity, right? And if you want, we can go in that direction. But, you know, as they grow, it becomes less about just the biology and more about the experience of being male or female, right? So just to give you a concrete example, the other day I had to teach my 12-year-old how to shave her legs because she's just getting to the age. And in the past, I mean, she's my third daughter. We have six children. And in the past with my eldest daughters, whatever, I just showed them how to shave their legs and sent them to the bathroom. But now with the whole gender and everything upon us, a light bulb went off and I said, oh, this is a wonderful moment for me to capitalize on teaching my daughter femininity. Okay. And embracing what it is to be a woman in this very small way. So I made a whole ritual out of it. I got bath bombs and I, you know, not to get into too much detail, but I taught her and I rolled up my pants and I showed her how to do it myself. And I told her, you know, part of being a woman, this is one of the things we have to do as women. And the whole thing was, I used it as the whole mother-daughter bonding moment, because now we really do have to be more explicit about embracing our femininity in so many countless ways. I would say the same thing to fathers teaching their sons how to shave their face. And so many of the little countless ways in which we dress and model for our kids a kind of noble femininity and a healthy masculinity. We have to make explicit what has been implicit for so many decades, because we can take none of these things for granted anymore. So we really have to, just lean into these opportunities much more than previous generations of parents did.
I want to stop you right there, because I think many parents discover it after the first few children or the first child are already into difficulties in adolescence and whatnot. That actually, I still don't want to go too fast over the fact that you can't do it the way your grandparents did it. It won't work, because the assaults on the child, daily assaults, are utterly different than what your parents faced.
Completely, completely. And another thing too, authoritarian forms of parenting that used to work in the past, or maybe they didn't work then either, but today they definitely don't work. And what I mean by authoritarian forms of parenting is, you know, lashing out. Like, so we'll have a lot of parents who come to Canavox, and their style of addressing these issues with their kids has been basically wagging their finger and angrily telling their children, our family doesn't do that. You know, don't ever engage in those kinds of relationships. It's wrong. It's always been wrong. It's contrary to the Bible, or it's against the catechism, or whatever. And it's just this, like, this just from on high kind of legislative authority commanding it. All right, some very docile kids may obey in the short term. You might get external obedience from that kind of communication, but it's not going to work in the long term. Okay. Really, what parents need to do today is lean into opportunities to speak calmly and kindly, explaining the why. So not only that this is wrong, but be able to explain why it's wrong and be able to do it compassionately so that our children understand we're not judging in a harsh way. What we want is the good for all people. So let me just give you another concrete example. Pride Month, June Pride Month, a lot of families flee from Target, right? Because Target is covered in all these posters and rainbows and gender ideology. At Canavox, some of our state leaders started to take their kids to Target during June Pride Month to show them the posters and use it as a teachable moment, use it as an opportunity to talk to the kids about false gender ideology. So the way I did it with my kids, we went to Target and I showed them this, you know, I went right to the section and there was this poster of this man. So he had a mustache, but then he had lipstick on And he was just very effeminate in any, every other way. And I, when my 9-year-old saw it, she just went, ugh, you know? I was like, yeah, why is that, ugh? Like, why is your internal alarm going off? And she explained in her own words why it was so grotesque to her. So yeah, that is grotesque. And you know what? The people here are trying to normalize this. And that's not good because you're trying to blur the line between men and women. And that's not really true, is it? It's not true to our biology. And so we had a wonderful conversation right there and then in the middle of Target. I mean, I even had like some side glances of other Target employees, like nervously listening right, to what was going on.
Yeah.
But right, that contrast that style with the authoritarian style of running away and getting angry and shutting it down, right? This other way of leaning in and shepherding our children, guiding them through the why, we think it's going to be much more effective.
And again, a secondary lesson for the child there is that these messages are constructed. They're not, people are making them intentionally. This is not just, you know, this is just how the world is. But mm-hmm. Target has a message it wants to send you. And that, right. That'll go for the TV shows you watch as well.
Totally, totally. And, you know, the younger they are, the more they absorb what mom and dad says. we usually say to parents, like, get to them before they're 15. In fact, we call the ages of 10 and 15, we call the strike zone. Because between ages 10 and 15, kids are so eager to understand what's going on in the world and the culture, and they really appreciate being spoken to as if they are adults. And they're also not yet cynical or in that adolescent phase where they're prone to not agree with their parents or rebel. So 10 to 15 is really a golden window when you can really start talking to your kids about all of these issues. Because by the time they turn 15, once those years begin, now they're really, you need to start letting your child now implement things more on their own. It's more of the age of you being more of a consultant to them, right? High school, you're the consultant and you're letting them sort of walk ahead of you a little bit more. So we really encourage, another saying we have is better a year too early than 5 minutes too late. So if you're doubting whether or not they're too young for you to explain something, better a year too early than 5 minutes too late, because the first person to get to your child gets to frame the issue. And they get to establish some kind of founding ideas in the child's mind. The next person to get to the child might then have to refute the ideas that the previous person gave and then reframe the issue. You're already at a disadvantage if you're sort of trying to clean up what they've already been taught. So better for parents to just get on it and introduce it first, even if you think it might be a little soon.
Boy, I can second that, because I remember realizing that there were other adults in my oldest children's lives who were being helpful to them, helping them overcome some of the prejudices that they were being taught at home. And I didn't know this. So there's very many helpful adults that are more than willing to help your children away from your values, and some of them in Catholic school, which also Absolutely. Came as quite a surprise to me. Okay, so there is a thing, however, about, you know, the Catholic is called to respect every stage of life and the needs of that stage of life. And there is a particular need for innocence at a certain age. And it's wrong for us, it's even called sinful, to disturb the innocence of a child. So how do we walk this line of letting them have this precious moment that Christ himself went through and made it glorious forever with that, but also make sure that we're arming them?
Right. Yes, this is a question so many parents struggle with, and it's a prudential issue. Okay. So what I mean is, this is a prudential matter on which reasonable people can disagree. So there's no black and white right answer or age or anything. Every parent has to use the virtue of prudence to discern this. And it will also depend on the personality of the child, whether the child is very, very inquisitive or not, whether the kid is very, very sensitive and easily upset or not, whether the child is in a environment, say daycare camp all summer from 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. and they're outside of your care a lot of hours or not, all of these things are going to have to be weighed by the parent as they make the prudential decision of how much to tell their child. And, you know, it's almost like giving them a vaccine, okay? You tell them, you give them a small dose of the evil so that they can be protected from larger doses of the evil, mm-hmm. okay? So that they can be street smart. So in addition, I would say this, okay? So we at Painovox, we don't know so much about church teaching. We use like the childhood developmental stages of Eric Erickson. He's the one who
okay.
was formally the authority on these issues. So the age of innocence for him was, you know, 0 to about 10 years of age. I think in our modern time, it's closer to 8. So 0 to 8, generally as a rule of thumb. But then also I would say, as soon as your kid starts asking questions, answer honestly. So for example, we live right next to a same-sex couple of women. And when they moved in a few months later, one of them is pregnant. And my 7-year-old asked me, "Mommy, let's just say her name was Brielle. Why is Brielle pregnant?" Like, you know, she was super confused because she knew that they were two women living
there. She knew about cows and bulls.
Yeah, she knew about cows and bulls. Here's my seven-year-old. So she's asking the question. So I let her ask the question, and I don't respond with fairy tales or white lies. Okay. You have to answer honestly and truthfully so that you're always gaining your child's trust. Right. So I said, "Well, that's a really good question, isn't it, Elena? Because there's no daddy in that house, is there?" She said, "No, there's no daddy. So, you know, why is she pregnant or how is she pregnant?" Said, "Well, you know, she unfortunately had to buy some seed and have it put in her body by a doctor." And she was just so, and I said, "And it's really sad because her daddy sold his seed so that she, and he promised to stay out of her daughter's life. And that's how she became a mommy." And my daughter's eyes started tearing up. She was just so sad by that. And that was a sign to me that that was enough information.
Yeah.
That was my prudential decision. Okay. But, and then we had a conversation about how important daddies are, you know, and why she's so happy that she has a dad in her life, you know, and that's it. I didn't say anything else. I answered her question simply, honestly. And I think at the level that she could understand, but that was it. Look, did I ruin her innocence? Maybe, according to some old textbook understanding of innocence. But this is the world we live in now.
Yeah.
And I would much rather be the one guiding my children into knowledge of these things so that they can have a correct understanding of the morality. So I can speak into her conscience, you know, in those moments. I'd rather be doing that than, as you said, some ideologue out there who's more than willing to teach her all about this in school in wrong kind of fairy tale ways.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me ask you concretely then about that 7-year-old or maybe a 9-year-old, 10, 12-year-old who asks about the person who has, and maybe it's a loved one, maybe it's a family member who used to be a boy, is now a girl, used to be a girl, is now a boy. Can you help me with that one?
Absolutely. So we always start with human dignity, right? And if you're Catholic or Christian, you can speak about everybody's made in the image and likeness of God, and everybody has dignity by design, and nothing they do can take that away. So we must always treat people with kindness and respect and love, even if we don't agree with their choices. Okay. So one of the things we love to say is we love all people, even though we don't love their choices. All right. So really emphasize love and respect for the person as your beginning point and as your ending point, right? And then in the middle, you can explain, all right, how do we know a boy is a boy? And then hopefully, because they've had their barnyard biology, they'll say, well, they have boys have boy parts and girls have girl parts. Yes. But did you know that it's not only their sexual organs? It's not just their vaginas or their vulvas. It's not just their penises. Did you know that every single cell of your body is either male or female, right? A 10-year-old can start to understand chromosomes and DNA and cells, right? So a very young child, you explain it in terms of sexual organs. Then once you start entering into middle school or getting closer to middle school, you know, cellular structure, every single cell is male or female. So even if somebody dresses like they're a female, if their cells are male, they are a male, all right? And no matter what they do, let's say he prefers to, I don't know, bake and work at a flower shop and do lots of feminine things, does that make him a woman? Nope, nothing that you do or whatever performance you put on, those things don't make you a woman. Your cells and your body make you a woman. So you're basically grounding them in the simple biological truth that our bodies are an essential part of who we are, and that can't be changed by costumes or even surgery. And then if you're talking to a high schooler, right, you can actually get into things like gender dysphoria. So you can actually talk to them about the psychological distress that sometimes these individuals suffer. Or if it's not distress, just social contagion, right? You can talk to a teenager about the power of peer pressure, about because that's a lot of what's going on right now, especially with girls, that girls are today often changing or playing around with their gender identities so that they're part of a accepted social group, right? So these gender identities are not necessarily reflecting some deep-seated feeling they've always had since they were little. No. It's basically the latest trend. And so the more you can explain to your teenagers, ideally around the age of 14, 13, early, so that once they get into high school, they start to see it all play out according to the script you already gave them, right? You give them these lenses to view the world through and they'll understand, ah, this is what dad was talking about, right? I can see the power of peer pressure here and why that girl would maybe dress that way or act that way in order to be more accepted, right? And of course, with teenagers too, if you're dealing, you can also explain it in terms of anorexia. It's always a really good analogy. And I got this example from Dr. Paul McHugh, who worked at, he was a lead chief psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins, and he worked for a long time with gender dysphoric patients. And he compared it a lot to anorexia. He said the individual has an overvalued idea in the mind. So, for example, with a girl who has anorexia, she has the idea in her mind she is fat, right? That's just her idea. She looks in the mirror, she sees that she is fat, even though she is extremely thin. And she will do all sorts of things to harm herself or to deprive herself of food so that she will lose weight. Now, what's the proper response to somebody who has anorexia? And all of this in the context of explaining it to a teenager, right? Do we say, yeah, go get a liposuction, or let's start a GoFundMe page so you can pay for those treatments so you can get thinner? No, we don't do that. What we do is we give that young woman mental health treatment therapy so that she can deal with whatever anxiety she has and learn to accept her body and who she is, right? It's the same with the transgender phenomenon. Whatever it is, that individual has an overvalued idea in their mind that is out of harmony with reality. So what that individual needs is not affirmation in the fantasy or cross-sex hormones or puber-suppressing drugs or, God forbid, surgeries. What that individual needs is compassionate, loving, psychological help so that they can become at peace with who they are, right? So you explain this to your teenagers and they will completely get it. And they will see that you are coming from a place of love and compassion, not judgment or hate or condemnation. And that, I think, is the secret recipe so that they don't think you're some sort of homophobe or something like the rest of the world says you are.
Right. Indeed, the rest of the world will say that you are, or at least imply it about you. Even if the world doesn't know you, they hear what you say. That's the judgment they'll come to, and want the child to come to that judgment. So, I can't keep you much longer, but man, I would talk to you all day if I could. It's very, very helpful, conversation. But just two more questions, if I may. First of all, many people who are dealing with this are not dealing with this from a position of parenthood, but aunt and unclehood or grandma and grandpa, or even just, friend of the family. And families react in all different ways. And so how might you approach the situation where, you know, a girl is transitioning or whatever the is happening, or she's presenting as a boy, and some of the family is accompanying that, and then some of the family is not, and then lots of people, I'm sure, don't know what to do and are horrified because they have no idea what they're supposed to do. Help me with that situation.
Yeah, so it's gonna manifest itself not in this theoretical broad question, but in tons of daily decisions. Do you use the young girl's pronouns? Do you use the chosen name she's wanted? Do you bring your young children over to see her or not? Right? These are all like a zillion little prudential decisions that each parent is going to have to make, or aunt or uncle is going to have to make. So, I mean, we could tackle it in many different ways, but generally here's the advice we give. And I give this advice after reviewing so many allegedly Christian programs for helping people with children who have LGBT kids. And I've seen, sadly, so many Christian organizations cave in the wrong way. So I really want to emphasize this. Our own personal integrity is really important. We need to really make sure that we practice what we preach and we say what we believe, and we do not say what we do not believe. A lot of people sort of sell out, or they go along with things in order to, quote unquote, save the relationship. In order to be an apostle, a quote unquote apostle, they will, you know, go along with things or enable the child to do things or affirm the child in a lie, because they want to stay in relationship. And I can understand that desire to want to stay in relationship. We want to always love our friends and family who are going through these transitions. However, the ends do not justify the means. And if we lack integrity, it's going to have a ripple effect on that relationship, and it's not going to work. So to cut to the chase, Helena Kirshner, who is a woman who transitioned and then she just detransitioned, she talked about how one of the key turning points in her life was she was already presenting as a boy. Everybody called her by her male new name, her male pronouns, but she had this art teacher she loved. And this art teacher was a great teacher and helped her all with her art, but she would never use those pronouns and she would never use her new name. She always called her by her birth name. And Helena Kirshner points out in her interview that that juxtaposition of being with somebody who was so fun, such a loving teacher, who so clearly loved her, but didn't use her name and pronouns, and didn't necessarily go along with certain statements that she made, it started to sow seeds of doubt in her convictions about the transgender thing. In other words, when we show love, but we do not cooperate or enable the person in the wrong way, it's very powerful on that individual, right? So I don't know if you want me to get into more details, Sai, but I would say that you have to find ways to stand your ground, but also compromise everywhere else that you can. You can still go to rock concerts with your niece or nephew, or you can still take them to the rodeo, or, you know, be involved in so many areas of their lives so that you can lavish them with affection and love, compromise in any other area. But when it comes to these issues of gender and sexuality, you have to quietly, you don't always have to preach with words. It may actually backfire if we preach with words. But whether it's with a smile on your face, or you just say, I'm sorry, I can't call you that, or can I call you by this nickname instead, or whatever, you know, that lavish them with affection, but don't compromise on your principles is, I guess, how I would answer.
Yeah, that's very, very helpful. The other question I wanted to ask you, because I'm very interested in your work, if you would just let us know about Canavox and what it is and how it works and how people can access it.
Yes. So the website is canavox.com, CANAVOX.com. So what it is reading groups. So the idea is that we're starting reading groups all over the world. We now have more than 600 reading groups, thanks be to God. And it's natural law based. So basically, individuals who want to study these issues with their friends in their living room, or, you know, turn their Bible study into a natural law, gender and sexual identity group, You basically go to our website, sign up, and you can also see the reading list online for free. And you meet with your friends, and it's like a book club, and you get together to talk about these readings, which have been very carefully vetted by a great staff of academics associated with the Witherspoon Institute, and by mothers and fathers and young professionals and young people all over the world who've helped collect and curate these reading lists, so that they're also just enjoyable as you learn. And it can really change your life. I mean, I would say Kane of Vox has changed a lot of people's lives and given a lot of people hope. So please, if you're interested in joining a reading group or starting a reading group and making a real difference in your community on these issues, don't hesitate to come to our website. We'd love to have you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Dr. Anna Samuel. I hope this is the beginning of a long association. It's very impressive what you do. And just to hear you speak, that gives me hope. I feel a lot of hope having spoken with you.
Great. Thank you so much. Please do pray for us, and we'll pray for you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Anna Samuel, our guest. Do check out Kane of Vox. And thank you for being here with us this week on Catholic Answers Focus. If you'd like to send us an email, maybe you want to comment on something that was said, maybe you have an idea for a future episode, just send it to focus@catholic.com. If you'd like to support us financially, you can do that by going to givecatholic.com. It does take a few bucks to do this. And as always, if you'd give us that 5 stars and a few nice words, that too will help to grow the podcast. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.